This is the South African Technology Podcast Series, where we talk to the end users of technology in business rather than to the vendors. Welcome to Tech Central's Meet the CIO, which is brought to you by NTT Data, where global experience meets local impact. I'm Duncan MacLeod, editor of Tech Central. I'm very pleased to welcome Tebalo Tshwaedi, CIO of the JSE, South Africa's largest and oldest stock exchange, to the show. Tebalo, thank you for your time. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No, it's my pleasure. So you've been in financial services pretty much your entire career. You started, I think, as an application developer for Rand Merchant Bank, but you've also worked at Standard Bank, Investec, Nedbank, First Rand, where you had your first CIO role, and also for Sanlam. And you've been CIO of the JSE now for 3 years. But take us through how you got into the IT management space. Was this always your plan when you were at school? I'm going to be a CIO. Take us through the path you've been on.
Okay, so I guess it wasn't always the plan. Mm-hmm. I'm a techie at heart, having studied computer science. I developed a passion for technology in my early years of high school, third year of high school.
What was your first computer?
My first computer? Jeez, I can't remember, but I can tell you that the first programming language that I used was COBOL.
COBOL,
and,
wow.
And okay. Database was DB2. This was in my third year of high school when my computer studies teacher introduced us to technology, and I just fell in love with it and decided to pursue it through varsity as well.
You must have really loved technology if you fell in love with COBOL.
Absolutely. And then I pursued a degree in computer science and mm-hmm. went on to do my honors. And, post that, I then got employed, as you mentioned, my first job being with RMB in their global markets division, specifically working on a number of projects there using Java technology mm-hmm. And a mix of .NET, C# here and there. So I really love, building technical solutions, and I saw myself really focusing on that and potentially eventually developing and further enhancing my expertise to become an architect, mm-hmm. Which is kind of like the pinnacle from one can reach from a technology SME perspective. So the intention was never really to get into management, and I guess it's something that just kind of happened along my career where At Investec, I got an opportunity to lead a team of software developers mm-hmm. On a specific project. And I guess that is where I actually realized my full potential with regards to leadership skills and leadership qualities and so forth. So I then decided to actually, give it a shot. And I decided to actually get a different view and pursue an MBA while I was still at Investec, playing a lead role. And that then exposed me to the commercial side of things and looking at how one could certainly leverage technology as a lever to enable business growth and enable the business overall. So I guess when I realized that, I was actually doing a good job from a leadership perspective, I then decided to make that switch and pursued, the path of a CIO. And as they say, the rest is history. I got a couple of lead roles within JP Morgan as well. And eventually, by the time I joined First Rand, I was literally ready to be a CIO, and that was my first CIO job, where the focus was really mainly on driving a lot of technology modernization and, mm-hmm. and transformation.
Do you think it helps for a CIO to have a technical background? I know there are some CIOs out there who come from a pure management or finance background, but do you find that having that technology background helps you in your job?
So I'll approach your question in kind of like a twofold manner.
Sure.
Firstly, if you were to ask me the same question maybe 10, 15 years back in the days, I would probably say yes. Technology background is quite key. But, the world has transitioned into a space where, in my view, the role of a CIO is no longer just to really, provide technical advisory. You certainly have your leadership team as a CIO that really delves into a lot of that technical detail. So if you don't have the right technical expertise, you can certainly leverage your overall technology leadership team. So we're in a world where CIOs are really expected to be a lot more commercial, entrepreneurial, and really kind of serve as in a role of kind of like a business growth where they enable growth of the business. So I think any individual that has really got the right skills with regards to looking at how you kind of mesh technology mm-hmm. and strategy, and certainly looking at how you leverage specific levers to enable business growth, then you can certainly mm-hmm. succeed in the role. So to answer your question, in this era that we're in, I definitely don't think, there is definitely a need for, extensive technical mm-hmm. expertise.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do you find yourself also playing a strategic advisory role? Because I imagine that in many organizations, and I'm sure the JSE is the same, the world of technology is moving at an incredible rate, particularly in the field of artificial intelligence at the moment. Mm. Do you find you have to play quite a strategic advisory role within the organization to help the board, to help a CEO understand the impact of these technologies potentially down the road on capital markets, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, that is essentially probably what takes up a lot of my time, mm-hmm. Having those conversations with the wider executive team, my CEO and the board as well. So technology is advancing at an immense pace, and it's quite important that you provide that guidance to your organization as the CIO to ensure that some of this technology as it emerges, you don't just jump on the bandwagon without really having a clear plan mm-hmm. with regards to how the technology will certainly assist with regards to cost optimization, efficiencies and productivity, as an example. So it's quite important that one really focuses on, putting in place the guardrails, the foundational elements that would certainly enable an organization to be best placed to leverage whatever technology it is that, wanting to adopt. It may be cloud, it may be generative AI, the list is endless. Mm-hmm. So, playing that strategic advisory role is quite pivotal.
And of course, the world of capital markets has changed fundamentally over the last, I was going to say, the last 5 years, over the last 20, 30 years, even more so. Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was first, I'm giving away my age here, but when I first started as a journalist, I remember there was no electronic trading back then. They were shouting to people on a board and they were writing it with chalk. Very quickly after that, of course, electronic trading arrived. I'm sure you're far too young to remember the shouting on the stock exchange floor. But maybe take us through what modern exchange looks like, trading exchange looks like today. What does your tech stack look like, and how has that changed just in the last few years?
So I guess looking back at where we come from as a capital markets ecosystem, to your point, there's definitely been significant advancements with regards to adopting electronic technology or electronic trading. So In a typical exchange, everything is fully electronic.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you're talking about trading, clearing, settlement, that's fully electronic and automated with quite a significant integration across various systems. Exchanges are quite have quite a complex technology landscape. So integration is also a key element. But I think significant developments is really around the adoption of high frequency trading,
mm-hmm.
where really you find that a lot of brokers, hedge funds, etc., really got into that space where they actually adopted technology that would give them, you know, an edge over their competitors, and ended up adopting high frequency trading. Another,
just what is high frequency trading again? Just remind me and our audience what it actually involves. Is this automated trading?
It's fully automated, but you know, with extensive, quick access to market data,
okay.
and ensuring that you access the best bid and offers within a very short period of time before there's actually any movement or there's very little movement in the price. So it's basically that in a nutshell.
So I imagine a lot of this is going on now, like particularly I think in the US. Let's say Alphabet publishes their quarterly results. I imagine there are artificial intelligence machines that are analyzing that the second it comes out, literally the fractions of a second, then making decisions and making recommendations and possibly even trading automatically
yes.
on the back of those financial results,
yep.
perhaps even without human beings being involved, just saying, well, we were expecting this level of earnings and this amount of cash flow and this amount of this, and this has actually come in here to trade based on that information. How much of trading is becoming automated today?
So in my view, I would probably say there's very, very, whether you take our markets into consideration or some of the global markets, there's very, very little that I would say is probably still conducted over the phone, where a trader or places an order and you know, the execution desk then acts on that, mm-hmm. and pushes it through to the exchange. So very, very little. It's mostly gone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's all fully automated. I think going back to the question you asked earlier on around some of the emerging trends from within exchanges, I would probably say, you know, the race to zero latency is quite something that is gaining a lot of prominence across the board, where exchanges are leveraging highly performant infrastructure to enhance performance of their matching engines.
You can trade a nanosecond earlier than the next guy.
Yes.
So get a better price.
So that is certainly something we're seeing, where there's been significant developments in infrastructure to ensure that, you know, the low latency requirements are met, whereby matching engines can perform at their best. Yeah.
Okay. So are you seeing that push towards low latency amongst brokers and investors and traders happening here in South Africa as well? And how are they getting that low latency? Are they literally putting up their offices right next to the JSE and plugging, getting as close to that server as they can?
Absolutely.
Is that how it works?
That's exactly how it works. So you want to be within, close proximity to the exchange's matching engine.
Yeah.
So what we've done as an exchange about 15 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, in 2015, we set up what we referred to as a co-location.
Mm-hmm.
So that is basically a space in our data center, which has been set up and is provisioned to market participants to come through, set up their infrastructure. So we provide rack space and power. they come through, they set up their own infrastructure.
Right there, in the same room.
Yes, and okay. then and then they have that low latency connectivity to our matching engine. And yeah, so at the end of the day, that's how we really facilitate you know, low latency from an execution or trading perspective. Yes.
That's astonishing. So I know I read a few months ago that the JSE is considering the option of 24-hour trading as well. How far is that down the line, and what would that involve from a technology perspective?
Yeah, so we've, as an exchange, we still have a lot of other priorities that we're focusing on.
Okay.
We're not necessarily considering it.
Okay.
We are aware of the fact that it is definitely an emerging trend, and some of the exchanges globally are working quite aggressively to get to a point where they actually implement.
Particularly the US exchanges, yeah.
Yes, 24/7 trading. But I don't think, you know, within the cash equity space specifically, there's any exchange that has actually launched 24/7 trading. So for us, it's really a case of ensuring that we very pragmatic in our approach in terms of, you know, adopting some of these trends, e.g. 24/7 trading. And it's definitely a journey that we would work with our market participant ecosystem and be very inclusive and collaborate with them just to really get a better understanding of, you know, what it means for us as an ecosystem. I mean, it does come with its challenges at the end of the day. You know, you need to have the right level of liquidity. There's a lot of dependency as well on shorter settlement cycles. We're still on a T+3 settlement cycle. As you will probably be aware, there's a shift, significant shift towards T+1.
So that means one day.
Yes, yeah. Literally, you
so
trade today.
It'll be settled and then in 24 hours.
In 24
or 72 hours. Okay.
No, in 24 hours, yeah. If it's T+1. So we work very closely with our market participants to get a better understanding of what the impact is from an ecosystem perspective. So I guess from a tech perspective, there would definitely be a need for. You know, some level of reconfiguration to ensure that, you know, processes run throughout the day, 24/7, nonstop. You know, we also have end of day processes that we need to cater for, so we would need to understand what it means for those types of processes and so forth. And I guess from a target operating model as well. You know, you now need to look at how you fully automate, I guess, your monitoring to ensure that, one, there isn't a need for an army of individuals manning this platforms 24/7.
Yes. I'm sure the last thing you want to be doing is watching the markets at 3 in the morning.
Absolutely. So it would definitely impact systems significantly and we would certainly have to look at how we reorganize ourselves. And similarly, I mean, there would definitely be a significant impact on our participants who form part of the broader ecosystem. So on their end as well, you know, it's really a case of how do they put in place the right processes to ensure that they continue to trade you know, from morning until the next morning, 24 hours. I guess, yeah, so it definitely would have quite
but it's not something you're rushing into. It's
no, we definitely not. It's okay. Definitely not something we're rushing into.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your relationship with Amazon Web Services. You have a relationship with them. Maybe just explain what that relationship is and what the JSE is looking to do in the cloud.
So our relationship with Amazon was really established when we embarked on, as the JSE, we embarked on modernizing one of our oldest legacy platforms, which is probably plus minus 37 years old. written in COBOL. I'm running on mainframe.
Which system was that?
It's called BDA. So that is a broker-dealer accounting system.
Okay.
In short, BDA. So it's really a system that is at the heartbeat of our cash equities market. Without that particular system, literally, the market would not operate. So very critical in terms of our operations. So we, as part of our overall tech strategy with regards to modernization and transformation of tech, we identified that particular solution as a priority for a number of reasons. Individuals that support COBOL as a programming language are reaching retirement. Some have actually reached retirement and have had to come out of retirement to support the likes of the insurers, the banks, ourselves as
COBOL
well.
COBOL's still huge in the banks.
Yes, it's still huge.
And it's the programming language that refuses to die.
Yeah, and the skill set is very scarce.
Mm.
But I guess over and above that, technology has evolved so much, and we felt the need to really transition that particular application or platform to modern technology so that we can better serve our ecosystem. We went through a very rigorous assessment where we identified multiple options with regards to what could be fit for purpose for us as an organization. And when we evaluated AWS's technology, it came out as one of the best in class out there. And we ran a POC with them, which worked very well. And I think what's exciting with the particular technology we utilize from an AWS perspective is that it's underpinned by AI. So essentially, what the tech does is it automatically converts COBOL code to Java code and accelerates the whole refactoring of code or modernization of code. So
were you converting all the COBOL to Java, or is it doing this in real time? Or
It absolutely. So without going into the detail around the fundamentals of how it works, so essentially, think of it as a sausage machine. You push through mince, and then it goes through the sausage machine, and then the output of that is your normal boerewors or sausage. Yeah. So it automates the whole process, but it's there's obviously oversight by actual Java developers who then ensure that the code that is converted from a functional equivalence testing perspective produces the same output as the legacy COBOL code.
Okay.
So we've recently completed a pilot.
So you're moving off COBOL?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, moving on to Java. And that.
Can
Java
you run COBOL in the cloud?
There is a possibility. Well, yes, you can.
Yeah.
You run it in the cloud through what we refer to as emulators.
Mm-hmm.
There are technology providers out there that provide those specific emulators that allow you to port your COBOL code base and they create a COBOL runtime in the cloud, and then you're able to then run that. But we certainly, obviously, no, that's not what we're doing. We're going the extra mile where we take in the COBOL code, converting it to Java and the latest version of Java, and then having that modernized Java application running in the AWS cloud.
And AI is helping you do that?
Yes. Okay. The AI that is specifically embedded within the AWS technology that we're using. So very exciting. We completed our pilot where we managed to convert 500,000 lines of COBOL code to Java. And we've signed that off from a testing perspective, achieved 100% accuracy in terms of what the modernized code produces as an output versus what the legacy COBOL code produces.
So is that live now in production?
So it's an MVP. Mm-hmm. So yes, it is in production, but it's not used by clients. So we've progressed to what we refer to as a mass modernization phase, where we converting the remaining 4.5 million lines of COBOL code to Java. So
is that also on the BDA system?
Yes, okay. That's all on.
That's a big system.
It's a big system, 5 million lines of code. So very exciting, and we're very optimistic, but we continue to be cautious. Mm-hmm. And certainly once this initiative is completed, it'll certainly set us up and our ecosystem for success going into the future.
So the broker-dealer accounting system, is this the thing that does all the settlements and everything else, or is that a different system?
So it does a variety of, I guess it's got multiple capabilities. We use it as well for member surveillance, where we basically monitor, the activity throughout the trading day. We mm-hmm. also use it for risk management. And lastly, our brokers use it for back office accounting as well.
Okay.
So it's we used within the JSE and within the broker community.
Okay.
Yeah.
So once the 4.5 million lines of code are done, it's going to take a while, isn't it?
We expect it to be done end of the year and launch.
End of this year? 2026.
Yeah.
Okay.
And launch in Q1 of 2027.
It's a lengthy. Yeah. It's a lengthy project. And do you eventually see the JSE's other systems, including its core equities trading platform, moving into the cloud, or will that forever stay on premises?
So I guess for me, and this is my kind of view, it's important to understand what the value add is with regards to migrating to the cloud. Mm-hmm. There definitely has to be, valid reasons. I don't believe in just migrating to the cloud for the sake of it.
If definitely. It's currently working, then why do it?
I guess as a start, for me, cloud opens up a whole lot of opportunities, not only from an AI perspective. If you have your data in the cloud, it's easily accessible. You can start looking at opportunities to monetize it and also democratize it. So the approach that we take is that we actually, review or explore what the value add is with regards to specific systems migrating into the cloud. And in some instances, you find that there's definitely opportunities from a cost optimization perspective. Then mm-hmm. certainly, yes, we go for it. So we're going through a rigorous process where we doing a detailed assessment to land on decisions pertaining to what should stay on-prem and what should stay in the cloud. But what's interesting is the work we're doing with AWS, where we bring in the cloud into our data center. So what do I mean by that is, the AWS infrastructure that you typically only, and cloud services and APIs that you typically only access in a public region when you deploy your solutions into the cloud. We working with AWS where we now bring in that cloud infrastructure into our data centers within close proximity to our markets, mm-hmm. and essentially starting to run proofs of POCs where we're looking at how the infrastructure, the cloud infrastructure performs within the exchange's data center. And I'm pleased to say, some of the POCs we've ran where we deployed our matching engine on AWS infrastructure that is highly performant and caters for ultra-low latency. We've seen, phenomenal results, which literally outperform the current SLAs we have mm-hmm. In place. So it's looking very promising. There's other tier one exchanges that have already gone live with their markets on AWS infrastructure mm-hmm. running in the exchange's data center. And that essentially is a concept that we refer to as bringing the cloud into into kind of like your markets, because with that infrastructure running within your exchange's data center, you immediately provide your market participants with access to cloud services within the co-location space, and then with also connectivity to the public cloud. And this really gives them great compatibility with, cloud infrastructure that they've adopted from a public cloud perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the JSE also has a technology partnership with the NASDAQ Stock Exchange, which is one of the biggest stock exchanges in the world, of course, and home to some of the biggest tech companies in the world, including Microsoft, NVIDIA, and I think Apple. Just tell us about that relationship with the NASDAQ and how that is flowing into some of the technology decisions the JSE is making.
Okay, so... what we've basically done with NASDAQ is that we've signed a memorandum of understanding, an MOU, which essentially allows both parties to explore opportunities around areas such as dual listings. Mm-hmm. For example, how do we put in place, seamless processes to allow South African companies to easily list on the NASDAQ Stock Exchange or in the U.S. and then similarly vice versa. From a tech perspective, what's quite key is that NASDAQ and AWS formed a strategic partnership a while back, which really focuses on building this infrastructure blueprint for capital markets that exchanges can then leverage. So part of us signing the MOU, we intend to really look at how we can leverage that blueprint infrastructure, specifically more from a global connectivity perspective, as it provides ease of access globally from a connectivity perspective, giving you access to multiple markets globally. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly something that we see as being a significant value add, for our local market participants if we certainly proceed with setting up that blueprint locally.
Do you see big demand for dual listings between the NASDAQ and the JSE in the coming years?
Look, I choose to believe that South Africa is definitely a great investment destination. We've seen, and this has been proven through some of the volumes we've seen come through post the GNU being formed, and that was certainly as a result of an increase in foreign investor confidence with regards to our economy. And mm-hmm. I am certainly of the view that we will certainly continue to see some of those foreign direct flows come through mm-hmm. Into South Africa.
There's a few companies with dual listings already. I'm in the tech space even. I think Karoo or Cartrack, I think they're also known as. And then, of course, there is Lesaka Technologies, which has a listing on the NASDAQ and on the JSE.
Yeah.
So there are a few of them. A few of them already. Do you think, by the way, that we're heading to, and looking at what's happening in the US, do you think we're heading to an environment where everything is done in real time? Do you think your settlements could be done in real time in future as well, or is that something that could only really be done with through batch processing?
So from a crypto perspective, I think that's already T0, so meaning real time.
Cryptocurrencies.
Yes, but I guess... from a cash equities perspective and other asset classes, there's certainly some considerations there. I would choose to believe that T+1, which is literally settling the following day, is quite great. However, there is definitely talk of... some of the markets moving to T+0. So
have they done that in the US yet?
Or no. I think they've, I can't recall, but they just recently well, maybe not recently, but they transitioned to T plus one.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they're currently at. And
so T plus one is state of the art. It's not like real time is happening around the world. It's not there yet.
No, it's not there yet. No. Yeah. No.
Okay.
Yeah.
And cryptocurrencies do it because of what? The blockchain?
Sorry?
Is it the blockchain that facilitates the real-time?
Yes, so that's the underpinning technology there is, blockchain.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a role for blockchains in trading, in equities trading? Is it something you've looked at all?
No, we haven't really looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
The type of technology that we have globally within the equity space works perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And there continues to be significant investment in really, improving the low latency and with regards to that race to zero latency, significant investments. And underpinning all of this is really the highly performing infrastructure that we're seeing continue to be developed. In fact, what a trend that we're seeing is one whereby exchanges are starting to actually partner with the infrastructure providers, specifically the hyperscalers, to build infrastructure that is fit for purpose for the capital markets ecosystem, mm-hmm. taking into consideration the performance that's required by markets such as equities.
Mm.
Yeah.
And at the moment, you have your own control over that. Of course, Amazon had that big incident just a couple of weeks ago, as of this recording, I think on the U.S. East Coast, which took down a number of companies. And that must be very concerning for trading platforms like yours, where being up all the time and available all the time with no degradation in service is absolutely mission critical.
Yeah. So for us, really, we continue to always collaborate and work very closely with our partners, e.g. the AWSs or Microsoft Azure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really boils down to how you certainly look at various architecture patterns that will ensure that from a redundancy and high availability perspective, you certainly mitigate the risk of, being down if a specific region goes down.
Mm.
So there's also a cost element, if you say, for example, want to have your main region as Cape Town, as an example, and then a backup in Europe, that comes at a cost as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the typical architecture is one where, typically organizations adopt that high availability and redundancy through multiple availability zones cater for.
So there are ways to manage it.
There are various ways to manage it, yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more about AI and machine learning. You spoke about how you've used AI to retool a lot of the COBOL code into Java on your BDA system. But what other roles do you see ML and AI playing in the JSE going forward from both an internal systems perspective, but also from the way traders are going to be using AI in the future to make decisions around what to buy and sell? Where is this taking us in the next few years?
So that's a very interesting one. I guess internally, as an exchange, we currently starting to explore a number of use cases in the AI space with regards to how we certainly, one, optimize our costs, be a lot more efficient, and also enhance productivity. In the space of software development lifecycle, we're looking at a specific tooling to enhance developer productivity, which ensures that developers no longer have to focus on mundane tasks, but they really focus on the value add, functions overall. At the same time, we are exploring how we certainly explore agentic AI within the software development space as well, to look at how agents can certainly form feature teams to augment developer capacity. So we run in these pilots or POCs, and you know, if successful, they will certainly set us up in good stead going into the future, where we certainly have options with regards to how we push code into production. I guess with regards to how traders leverage AI, one would probably certainly argue and say with algorithmic trading that's been around for a while, it's powered by machine learning, which is...
It's already been probably one of the earliest industries to adopt the technology.
Yes, absolutely. So it's not something new. I guess where I probably see it adding even further value is really around some of the current workflows that are, I guess, semi-manual, and there's opportunity there to leverage AI and look at how you fully automate those trading workflows within that trading environment. And then linked to that would obviously be what's been existing in terms of algorithmic trading. Yeah.
So if it kind of supercharges the algorithmic trading that we've seen so far, and we have more and more algorithms and large language models, whatever you want to call them, making trading decisions on behalf of traders, obviously according to a set of rules, do you think it introduces any systemic risk in the system? I mean, if robots are making 99.9% of all the trading decisions on a daily basis, you know, could they also hallucinate and make errors? And could that cause problems on capital markets? Could it lead to a market crash?
So I guess, you know, just going back to the point I made earlier on, algorithmic trading has been around for a very long time, and it's worked very well. And I guess really with regards to the introduction of this large language models that particularly focus on, you know, trading, it's just really a case of looking at how you complement what's already in place. And my view is that these models are highly trained, and there's a lot of effort that goes into really ensuring that the decisions that they make are on point. I'll give you a good example, you know, just kind of deviating away from the trading world, where, you know, you have the likes of Copilot, ChatGPT. The results that, you, in fact, with as the models are further enhanced, the results that you get as you interact with such a tech or AI tech are really amazing, and the level of accuracy is actually quite shocking. It's so accurate that you would actually wonder, you know, how does one get to really getting a model to be this accurate? So I think, you know, there is that awareness of the fact that if you are going to be deploying these models in an environment where if there's any mistakes, then the consequences would be devastating. So significant effort definitely goes into ensuring that from a model training perspective, you know, they are as accurate as they can be.
Okay. And human beings will always need to provide some level of oversight. But I suppose we should always remember that humans make mistakes as well, not just machines. Are there any other, as we move to conclude the discussion, are there any other emerging technologies that you're excited about in the capital market space at the moment? That what's coming down the line, apart from AI, which everyone talks about at the moment, that has you excited?
So I would probably say at the moment, we're definitely seeing a lot of focus on AI and cloud adoption. So we
those are the two big things.
Yeah, those are the two big things. And I think there isn't any piece of technology that is adopted globally that is kind of only specific within capital markets.
Okay.
We leverage this emerging technology and then just kind of use it to gain a competitive edge through the solutions we build. Yeah.
Okay. Tabalo, before I let you go, I'm asking all my guests on Meet the CIO in this season to share their favorite productivity hack. What's yours?
I'll probably say Copilot.
Okay.
Use it quite a lot in my day-to-day admin tasks.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly...
So to write emails...
Yeah, a lot of more specifically to summarize meetings,
okay,
etc. The typical stuff that you typically maybe require a bit of time to do on your own and so forth. And as I mentioned earlier on, the level of accuracy is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from that, I enjoy traveling a lot. But what I've seen is the AI elements that are now embedded in browsers actually assist quite a lot with regards to helping you plan your trip. So, for example, I can literally within a matter of a few minutes be able to book a flight, a hotel, know what availability is there from a flight perspective, accommodation, and so forth. And that gets packaged and immediately... I'm able to then have my trip finalized. So that seems to work quite well for me.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to the day when I can just pick up my phone and talk to my AI chatbot and say, please buy me 5,000 Capitec shares at a maximum share price of X. And I can just leave my phone and I know it goes off and does it.
Yeah, we definitely
are
moving towards that world where you will certainly have that level of capability, available to the masses.
Mm.
Yeah.
Tebalo Tswaedi is CIO of the JSE. Thank you for a great discussion, and thanks for speaking with Tech Central's audience today. It's much appreciated.
Thank you.